Seeing new faces at every meeting and every sort of interaction that I have with groups around Glasgow, that's what's really keeping me going.
All right, hi everyone, welcome to Fossil Free Now, a podcast by Fossil Free Glasgow about all things related to climate activism. My name's Scott, I go by he, him, and I'll be facilitating today's discussion where we're going to look at tactics for social change and a just transition, hopefully building on last week's discussion on visions for a fossil free society. This is all the more apt because today we're joined by two members of Extinction Rebellion, who goes without saying have been a very prominent voice in the environmental movement over the last few months. So we'll be using today's discussion as a chance to hear both their perspective on today's topic and also about some of the actions that they've taken part in. And hopefully as well, we can use to sort of compare and contrast their own experiences and our own ideas for this, for how we want to change the world into a super place. So I thought maybe like the first thing we could do is just go around the table and everyone can sort of introduce themselves and their pronoun, and then maybe the our friends from Extinction Rebellion, if they want to. Mathieu, do you want to go first?
Yeah, so I'm Mathieu, I go by he, him.
I'm Hannah, I go by she, her.
I'm Dan, and I use he and they pronouns.
I'm Zara, I use she, her pronouns.
I'm Yenny, I also use she, her pronouns.
Louise, I use she and her pronouns.
Bobby, and I use she, her pronouns.
Excellent, so yeah, we're joined by Anna and Bobby, who are both from Extinction Rebellion. So I thought we'd maybe just start by asking yourselves how you got involved with Extinction Rebellion and how you became such bold climate activists.
So I've been really enjoying listening to your Fossil Free podcast because I feel like I've kind of moved in an opposite direction from you guys, because it seems like you started with this kind of quite, okay, it's a focused divestment movement, but from a kind of broad climate agenda of really wanting to make things change, and you've kind of gone much more into a more kind of focused on foraging and growing things and activism through building relationships and through training. And I feel like I've kind of gone the other way, because I felt quite like there wasn't any point in trying to save the world. So I felt for a long time like the best kind of activism that I could do was more like focusing on valuing the world as it is and valuing nature and doing things like foraging and natural dyeing and crafting and thinking about ecology, but not really trying to change anything, because, yeah, there's not much point. I suppose, probably like a lot of people, the IPCC report really shocked me. What I think really broke my heart was the WWF report. But also, I think I felt there was more hope from the IPCC report, and because it also did contrast with finding out about Extinction Rebellion and the things they were up to in London. And what I liked about them was that they seemed to be trying to combine this kind of big, bold climate statements with a real focus on natural, kind of really genuine social change, but also on relationships with each other as activists, and it being focused on being as well as doing. So I really liked all their write-up and stuff, and I dialed into an online call that somebody set up for Extinction Rebellion in Scotland, which I couldn't take part in because my dogs were barking, and it was because it was firework night. So I just was listening to other people talking, and I heard someone who's now a guy who's one of the kind of Extinction Rebellion Scotland and Extinction Rebellion Glasgow coordinators. He was on it, and he set up a talk, which happened about a week or so later, and then I met Bobby, and it was very intense and very kind of a meeting, which we were all packed into this tiny room. Loads of people, and yeah, I kind of ended up sending Guy an email, and he sort of liked how I phrased something, so I decided I should do media. So I ended up setting up a Twitter account, and things just kind of snowballed, and it's taken over my life. So that's me.
Can I just ask then, did you almost throw yourself into it? Was it maybe, this is maybe not the right phrase, but was it done to a certain extent on a whim almost? Do you know what I mean?
I felt and I've been thinking for quite a long time about I'm an academic, but now I've been a kind of very precarious, very part-time academic for a long time since my getting my PhD. And so I've been thinking a lot about what I want to do with my life and what this is for. I write about environmental theology a bit, and I was really like, why am I doing this? I was definitely waiting for something like this to come along. It did feel like it came along at exactly the right time for me. And because I work very part-time, but also in the kind of work that does pay enough for people to live on, and it felt like something that I could commit to doing quite a lot with at this point in my life. So to some extent, I didn't realise I would become as it would take over as much as it has, but I was prepared to be like, right, okay, this is something I want to commit one or two days a week to.
I think for a lot of people that's the experience, it's kind of percolating in their sort of subconscious, and then something comes along that almost triggers them, and they go from this period of being maybe not too involved in things to being all in and being committed. Yeah, I mean, me, yes. You, yes, Ara.
Yeah, me too.
Bobby, how is it you got involved?
I heard about Extinction Rebellion through Guy, my boyfriend, so it was slightly kind of hearing things secondhand, and I grew up being an activist teenager and then having a lot of my 20s being very much more about working and, you know, trying to work out what I was doing kind of work-wise and thinking about PhDs and thinking about all sorts of different things that I was going to do. But, yeah, completely disengaging from lots of the things that had really interested me when I was growing up. And I was one of the people that organised my school to walk out for the Iraq War, and that was really exciting. Mm. And we blocked the Parliament Square and sat down in the road, so I had some little interaction with a policewoman, you know, at that age. And it's all coming back into my life again now that Extinction Rebellion has. So heard about what they were planning to do, and didn't, because it was hearing secondhand, I've got a really silly way of thinking that if it's not my idea, I'm not really on board. So just kind of learning a little bit more about it and not really thinking it was something for me. You know, there's lots of other things that I was hoping to get involved in when I moved to Glasgow about a year ago. And then suddenly, the more I learned about Extinction Rebellion and what it was trying to do and how easy it was for people to sort of get on board and organise that in a very autonomous way. And it covers so many of the different things that that I was interested in. So lots of the kind of diversity and intersectionality stuff has come up recently that we're really working on at the moment. So it's it's very exciting times. And it's felt like it's something that actually empowers people. And watching people get empowered as they find out more about it is really, really nice to watch.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for sharing. That's amazing that you actually came back into activism as well after a...
Actually, I'm kind of just like drawing parallels now with the youth climate strikes and how you're talking about the Iraq War strikes, and that was what kind of maybe is what led you to where you're at now. And I kind of saw that with the young people on Friday in Glasgow, that these are the people who are going to be like fighting this fight in the future, and maybe they need a few years out to find themselves after school and things like that, but we all come back to it, and it's a really important training. So
yeah, absolutely. And seeing the youth strike and seeing lots of kind of people older than me that had got quite depressed came along kind of by chance to the youth strike, and everyone I spoke to was just saying how much it really meant something, and how emotional they felt, and it was it was really, really exciting. So kind of the more that we can see young people on the streets, the better, but it also means everyone can do it, you know, even if you do have a boring job.
Awesome. So yeah, like as we've touched on, you've been busy people over the last few months doing lots of interesting actions. One action that's perhaps the most noteworthy was when you occupied the Scottish Parliament. I remember seeing it on the news, I was amazed. It was on STV News. But maybe just before we move on to the kind of more tactical parts of the action, what was it like doing it? How did it feel doing it?
It was quite an interesting action because it was planned with a very small sort of affinity group, so a group of people that organised and planned it, and then spread the word to essentially tell people to turn up at a certain time. So not being part of the organising of an action was quite an unusual experience, and you know, you had to basically put your trust in what was being done. So turning up fairly blindly and having a briefing, but by the end of a very thorough briefing, it was very clear that every aspect of this action had been planned out, and the sort of messaging and why we were doing it, and there was a lot of symbolism that was had been incorporated into it, and I think everybody in a room really bought into it, and there was a lot of nervous energy, but I think, you know, we thought if we could pull it off, it was going to be a really good day, and it did turn out to be.
Yeah, I can't remember if when we were talking on the train, if you were planning to be arrestable or not. I don't know if you guys' activism has worked in quite the same way, but often people go in, there are people who are arrestable and there are people who aren't. Mm. This was one where those clear boundaries weren't really going to work, because anybody who went into Scottish Parliament and went into the debating chamber and was maybe potentially arrestable. So, but I had gone in thinking, okay, I'm going to do live streaming, I'm not going to be arrestable on the Facebook and on Instagram and Twitter. And then I realised, okay, it can't be live streamed on all of these different platforms unless somebody who's doing it is prepared to be arrested. Maybe, but probably not. And I felt like it felt like something. I think I'd felt a sort of sense of trust in the people that were talking us through it at the briefing. And I thought, I want to do this, and I'll regret it if I don't. And there was definitely a sense that we could choose not. That if at some point, no, I'm uncomfortable, I want to try and withdraw from the situation, we would still be able to do so. So, yeah, I thought, I want to do it. But I don't know if for you it was a kind of more of a last-minute decision like it was for me, or if you'd already felt like, OK, I'm going to risk this.
Well, I was supposed to be working, and I had quite a lot on that day, so I actually didn't make the decision to go until sort of the Wednesday or Thursday. But I felt... yeah, really like it was something I could... Well, no, actually, just in retrospect, it was something I'd really wanted to do. So, it was quite a gamble to go along. But I feel like we have, in a very short amount of time, really built trust between people, even sort of groups in Edinburgh and further afield. So even around Scotland through sort of... kind of conversations online and via all the different kind of channels that we communicate through. It was a real sense of kind of community and coming together to do something in a large, I think the larger the numbers in some cases, the better you feel about something. And knowing there was a way out at each point, that had been very clearly sort of marked out that, you know, any point you're out and, yeah, you can sort of recognise in each other what people's boundaries are.
Mm. And did people actually end up being arrested? And obviously you got a lot of media attention. Do you guys feel like that was the kind of main thing that came out of it, that like the cause got a lot of focus on it? Or do you feel it was a success?
Yeah, it was. We got the word citizens' assembly in the Scottish Sun, you know, things like that, and on Reporting Scotland and on STV, we got them talking about climate emergency. So yeah, it was very much, this was an action that was aimed at the media, but it was really well thought through and really well done by the people, particularly one person, Mim, who kind of is a complete force of nature with Extinction Rebellion Scotland press. So and it was all very, very carefully planned out how it would be communicated. So when once we sat down in the Scottish Parliament, having booked on these two tours, which dawdled, one which rushed through quickly, and then so once we'd sat down, then one of the legal observers sent Mim a text saying this has happened, and then she sent out the proper press release, because there was a "this something fun is going to happen, you might want to come and be around" press release, but this is what we've done. And also we had like spokespeople who were trained to talk about the action afterwards and really explain what we were doing and why. So that was a really important part of it. I think if we'd just done it, and it could have just, like, no one could have known, and one of my colleagues in the media and messaging team did say that the thing is, if we do actions and no one knows about them, then you're just masturbating, basically. That's the importance of getting the press out.
And some of the actions that Extinction Rebellion around the UK and actually around the world, the aims are often to get arrested. It's to show how sort of urgent the situation is, and people from all sorts of walks of life have got to the point where it's important enough to be arrested. And in this case, it was very much sort of liaison with police, and it ended up not being an arrestable action because of the communication between us and the police through all of it. Yeah. And also a very clever decoy up the road.
Yes. Mm. Yes, there was another event up at St Giles, a rally, and the police, there were loads of police there, and they were saying stuff like, is this it? Because they'd known there'd been lots of NVDA trainings happening in Edinburgh leading up to it. And actually there was this delicious moment when some of us were going through the security at the Parliament, and they... obviously someone had just printed off a briefing and they were reading it and saying, oh, is that the lot that blocked off the bridges in London? They'd never do anything like that in Scotland. They don't have the capacity. Which, no, we probably wouldn't have the capacity to block five bridges in Scotland, but we did to get into the Scottish Parliament and make a big statement about, not just about something is wrong and it needs to change, we're prepared to get arrested to make it change, but to show what we want things to become. We want a different kind of democracy, and we want citizens' assemblies to be a way of deliberating about climate emergency.
Yeah, so the reason why we decided to have this conversation today was to look specifically at how do we move from the world that we're in right now to the world that we actually demand? And so how would you say that an action like this would contribute to bring about the world that we're trying to bring?
I think so Extinction Rebellion has three demands, and the first is to tell the truth about the climate emergency and act as if the truth is real. And the second is to have net zero carbon by 2025. And the third is a citizens' assembly to oversee the first two demands. So having a citizens' assembly in Parliament on a day that they're not there and making decisions and discussing... We actually discussed carbon cap and share for about half an hour, which the police and security must have thought was a really bizarre thing to be doing after having done some poems and some readings, talking about cap and share and working through kind of how that would affect society, and basically showing that we can make decisions if we're sort of given the space and the and the expertise to think about it. But having a representative group of people that are not thinking about their profits or thinking about... we lack transparency in a lot of the things that our councils and governments are doing. And so, yeah, being able to be empowered and make decisions is really, I think, where we want to be.
I mean, yeah, I guess in general, with the kind of actions that are aiming to get visibility for an issue, the tactic that it goes with is kind of putting pressure on the government to make the changes happen that we're asking for, or then to affect or like to spread knowledge and get more people to demand the same things. So yeah that's probably the kind of like the broader means that kind of actions use to get to the fossil free society.
Yeah it's interesting that because it, like, an action like this, from what you've been talking about, ticks so many boxes. It has empowered a large number of people to actually embrace resistance. Because like an action like that is a form of resistance, and the kind of things that we would need in order to move to a fossil-free society would be, first of all, a culture of resistance. So the empowerment of people has been one of the crucial... wins of an action like that. But also, as you say, it wasn't only just a platform to put demands to the Scottish Parliament, but it was also demonstrating how those demands would actually be put into place. Like, I didn't even know that you, inside the Parliament, you kind of role-played a citizens' assembly session, and that's pretty brilliant, because that shows that the demand that we're doing right now would be implementable right now if we wanted to. So. Mm-hmm. And so in itself, that's quite of a good way to ask the, rather than asking the government to do it, you do it yourself, and then it's kind of obvious.
So the week of April the 15th, well, the weeks after April the 15th, we'll be having an international rebellion. And in the lead up to that, there's going to be lots of chances for us to be holding more citizens' assemblies around the country. So having more, you know, we've kind of had a trial run, but we can keep doing it, and involving more people in that process, and kind of showing over and over and over again that we can come to really good decisions when we're all involved in those processes.
Yeah. So I should say that what we were doing with this was a symbolic citizens' assembly, the sort of the technical sense of a citizens' assembly, which I think Extinction Rebellion are defining through residence rather than immigration status. Mm-hmm. It's very much something that's a group of people populated through sortition, so being representative of the broad demographics of the area where it's being decided. So technically what we did was a people's assembly, but I think we were happy enough to call it a symbolic citizens' assembly.
And just like, I mean, it's been shown to work when it's actually implemented. Like, if we look at what happened in the south of Ireland with the abortion referendum, something that politicians were insisting that they couldn't talk about because the Irish public didn't want it, and that's what then pushed for the referendum to happen and that historic result that finally like freed a lot of women and people with uteruses in Ireland. So yeah, it's been shown to work, and it's been shown to work for really what would have been classed as difficult issues, so it was a great strategy. Mm.
Sky News, if they talk about climate change at all, it's like seen as this very technical issue which people mm-hmm. can't engage with. And if you use like this language, which we're kind of told as activists not to use, you're told to give people like you know, like little crumbs and things that they can like little hooks to pull people in, and not really give them the whole truth of how dramatic and bad the situation is. So like, but you've like started off by calling it XR Extinction Rebellion, and it's a threat to like all life on Earth. It actually draws people in, and it's an empowering experience. It's just like, I think that's, there's something really beautiful about that, and I think it must speak to the culture that you create within your organisation, like that's possible.
Yeah, it's been really cool to see this like massive, massive new player to show up in Scotland as well. Because, well, we've been doing activism, like climate activism, here for some years now, and it's been fun to see how we can use our knowledge to kind of support these new, much bigger players as well. Because we've gained a lot of experience in like how to facilitate meetings and how to be a caring group and how to support each other through actions, and it's been a really nice to have the option for our action to be the act of kind of supporting others in activism.
Mm. It's also just taken a huge weight off our shoulders. Like, I mean, like last year, I think at some point it just felt like I knew everybody in the climate movement in Scotland, and I was like, we were always fighting against a very big brick wall, and then like Extinction Rebellion came in and I met all these like loads of people who really care about the same thing as me, and I just felt you're less alone in it, and like actually that it was very possible to challenge and change things when there's more of us involved.
Yeah, I was amazingly struck by how sparse the climate movement was. I felt like I was at the vanguard of it. I was like, how's this happened?
Yeah, I'd like to like bounce back on the point that Dan made, that it's really brilliant that a group like Extinction Rebellion kind of breaks all the all the theories of climate communications that had been made by people in NGOs or within academia of, like, there's something that's often talked about, which is like the ladder of engagement, which is that like people start doing smaller things, and then as they become aware of these smaller things, they would move on to bigger things. And that's why there's so much emphasis within mainstream NGOs to like wage a war against plastic straws, for instance, because the theory behind that is that by engaging people on the little things that don't matter, then they will be more engaged about the bigger things in the long term. But and it's been deeply depressing, like when you're already engaged in the climate movement, to see so much energy going into those little things. Mm-hmm. But Extinction Rebellion did completely the opposite by giving the radical truth and being honest about it. It galvanized so many more people that really felt disengaged by the mainstream climate movement. So that I think that's a brilliant aspect of Extinction Rebellion, and I wish more groups would be radically honest.
It kind of feels like the whole ladder of engagement kind of feels like the argument for capitalism, that wealth will trickle down as well, and it always felt so disingenuous. And really glad to see that the stuff that I think spoke to our group was those bigger messages that really did challenge people to change their lives completely and not go halfway, and to see evidence that people feel like that as well was brilliant, and that was great part of your group.
Yeah, so it has been interesting though, because there is this balance as activists between being part of a movement that has extinction in its title, and that we are really obviously trying to convince people that this is really, really urgent, and we are in a state of emergency and we all have to act now. And I think that can be quite difficult, if it's especially for people for whom it's a more recent realization. There's a lot of people in our movement that are dealing with a lot of grief and a lot of fear. And so when I do quite a lot on the social media, and we do, you know, we have a lot of emergency messaging, but we try to make sure that we have these crumbs of something more positive, which often is that we are acting, that we are doing something together. And that's actually been a big part of the kind of the main values of Extinction Rebellion, is that it is about taking care of each other as activists, and making sure that we're kind of doing inner work as well as the doing and going out and getting stuff done, that we're also taking time, like we always begin every meeting by saying how we're doing, things like that, that I think are really important about the movement but haven't really been picked, aren't so well known by the media.
Yeah, I would say that's not something that comes across in the kind of messaging that is given out, and one of the great things is XR like gets a lot of media, but that's not something, like, we hear a lot of things about being arrestable and like all these kind of things, but it's really important and really great to know that there is that kind of sort of care culture as well, because one of the things that we've all experienced as activists is the kind of burnout and the really kind of like dark days when you sort of realise how difficult things are, and what makes the sort of sustainability of our group is that culture. And yeah, just be nice to hear like a bit more about how you're building that culture to sort of create that sustainable longevity too, because right now it's got a lot of energy.
So Extinction Rebellion probably hit most people's news screens in October, November last year, but the organisation behind it, Rising Up, has been going for a couple of years, so 2016. And they've done. There's been lots and lots of research into successful protest movements and what has worked, and the burnout that activists, or conscientious protectors, as we are calling ourselves, we're just normal people who who are out sort of telling the truth and trying to get everybody else to act. But yeah, the regenerative culture side of things. We kind of organised through lots and lots of different working groups, and the regenerative culture sort of side of things is very much feeds into every single aspect of how we're organising, and lots of kind of training and facilitation to try and ensure a lot of the things that we've seen in your training as well. And there's we've taken away quite a few things from coming to the action training that you guys did a few months ago.
Yeah, so they have an action well-being representatives of teams as a core part of all of the actions that we do, but as well as that, there's this more underlying sense of renewing and nourishing culture that's behind it all, and those are interrelated tasks. And so things like conflict resilience or conflict shifts training and things like that, accepting that people aren't always going to agree. I think a lot of the people that are doing a lot with regenerative culture and Extinction Rebellion have had work a lot with Joanna Macy's training, the work that reconnects, and things like that. But I do remember thinking a couple of months ago that I'd not heard people talk about the phrase self-care, which you just hear everywhere all the time, in Extinction Rebellion, because there is so much emphasis on taking care of each other that the onus isn't on you. And I'm not denigrating movements that do talk about self-care as a really radical and important thing to do. I'm not, but it was kind of refreshing that actually it's not just a case of me thinking, right, I need to take time out now, but also people are like, Anna, you said you were going to take some time out, why aren't you taking any time out? and things like that.
Without somebody having that sort of, like, I don't know, mutual culture, and what I'm like, I would be like, I would just ignore it and work till burnout. So having humans around me who can be that good influence, so important.
Yeah, I think there's something really positive about that. Like, it seems to be, like, rather than, like, use the word, like, it's not like a vanguard movement, it's not like a few people have all of the knowledge and expertise and are going to take this forward. It's trying to create, like, this culture of activism, which is much more, like, autonomous and is also about, you know, spreading these skills, which is just seems to be really inspiring. So, yeah, and I think, like, the idea of, like, affinity group, you can think of it as being in this really practical sense and it has a purpose there, but, like, I think you can also think about the term in terms of, like, the emotional sense. Like, we're also, like, checking in on each other and making sure, like, we're okay. And it's really cool that we've got, like, that going on between our two movements. Like,
yeah, I feel like we're going maybe too much into the group culture conversations, but it's really reassuring to hear how sustainable Extinction Rebellion, at least in Scotland, seems to be. Since it used to, like, really worry us in our conversations during last autumn, when we only saw the kind of, like, people want to get arrested kind of side of things, and that's why we kind of organised the training and all, just to kind of make sure that this new big movement will have all the tools that they need to be sustainable. And so good, like, it's such a relief to hear that it sounds like this is a thing that can continue being huge for a long time.
Also, like, it's really, really positive for me to, like, hear in the conversations we've had in the past few weeks about today, like, about intersectionality, that's incorporated into the movement, and it's something which is integral to, like, your organising. Because I suppose, like, my initial fear was when I heard about, like, people going up to sign to be arrested, they sign up to be arrested, I feared there'd be, like, a hierarchy in the movement of the people who feel like they could do that, and then people who, like, they don't have their status, or, like, they don't have the relationship where they feel like they've got people around them who are able to support them aren't going to be able to participate in that way. So there'd be, like, a hierarchy between the people who can get arrested, which mostly be white men probably, and then other people. But, like, it's really cool that there's so many different ways of engaging and that you're having, like, conversations about those things. But, and I don't think it is reflected, like, in some of the way that the media has talked about Extinction Rebellion, because they like to keep issues really separate. But it's really cool to know that that's happening. Like,
I think everyone comes from such different places, and we're trying to recognise that for Extinction Rebellion is kind of asking people to move beyond their comfort zone and to whatever their kind of previous activity has been. You know, writing a letter to an MSP is such a big deal for somebody who has never done that. There's other things that people can do, you know, turning up to a protest and never having done that before, or doing something like occupying the Scottish Parliament, or doing a lock-on, or blocking a bridge. You know, it's trying to ensure there's a sort of safe space for people to do that, and understanding that, you know, going and getting arrested is not for everybody, and it's the you know, trying to be an inclusive action sort of movement rather than asking everyone to get arrested, because that's, we're not going to get very far if we do that.
I'm always a bit wary about seeming unrelentingly positive and us coming in here going, yeah, everything's lovely in Extinction Rebellion, because it's not always. There is an awful lot of work that needs to be done around intersectionality. there is a lot of recognition of the privilege of being able to be get arrested, but I think a lot more thought that needs to happen in both in Scotland and down in England. It's kind of struck me recently that there's quite a lot of people in the movement for whom being scared is quite new to them, and it's recognising a sense of privilege of, and how they're and how they're reacting to their fear isn't. They need to adjust that for people for whom the world has always been scary in lots of ways, and that's something that is going to be a challenge for people who are more cognizant of issues of decolonisation, intersectionality, and moving forward. And so there's some issues with messaging coming up. I'm just thinking in a couple of weeks you're going to be quite surprised about some of the Extinction Rebellion things that we've been talking about. There's the There are ways that the messaging, is still problematic in some areas. So although there's all this brilliant stuff happening and really lots of brilliant work, it's not perfect by any means.
Training because we've been trained by other people who were more experienced than us, and that's how a lot of like our movement works, is the kind of skill sharing. I just wondered if there was any plans for you to do any training, particularly in the things that you seem to be really good at.
There's a lot of training going on behind the scenes, and there's every hour of every day it almost feels like you could log in and be part of an online webinar, so spokesperson training or facilitation training, or you know, dealing with non-violent communication. I don't think those are often done, you know, online. But trying to move that out to sort of more public spheres is really important for us to kind of broaden our reach. And one of the things I'm trying to do as part of my job, I've got quite a good sort of platform for putting on events and things like that. So a challenging colonialism in climate activism talk an event next week. So yeah, trying to do things that are more outward focused is really kind of the next steps for us.
So we did get invited to do a talk and do a little bit of training, a workshop at the 2050 climate movement, which was, I didn't realise that was where you guys had done your Nicola Sturgeon action until I was talking to one of the volunteers organising that module on the phone. As I was like, oh, have you heard of these guys, Fossil Free? They do really great workshops, so maybe they might know what they're doing a bit more than we do. And she said, yeah, they did this action. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I thought, wow, it's really big that they've asked us to come and do it. But it was, and we did it at the weekend, so we did one very short session on taking direct action, why, and totally ripped off your kind of spectrum activity of is it direct action and is it effective, and the second one we talked more about well-being and regenerative culture and acknowledging climate and ecological grief. And some of the feedback we got from that session from the organisers was that was really useful for them, and that's something in what they're doing that they need to think about a lot more, and also think more about their messaging. Because there was at one point in our, generally we went in there with a sense of, okay, we're going to be polite, but not, you know, not diverge from what our main reason for being is. So there was a point where we'd all been doing exercises pretending like we were a city councillor, where at one point my colleague sent me a WhatsApp message saying we're doomed because of all the ways that these young people were going to the minds of people in power. But then at the end we did speak about, hold on, this is an emergency here, folks. So it was good to get that message out through the more normal channels of how they work, which I think you guys really paved the way for. I don't know if they would have invited us if you hadn't done what you've done.
Yeah, because so we've been talking a lot about changing culture, and I think that's crucial because like changing the minds of people and the expectations that people have of society is going to be the foundation for any meaningful sustainable change that happens. We've also talked a lot about messaging and of like how much power we put into words, of like how the ideas that we convey are going to be what is going to change society. But one thing that we haven't really talked much about is the role of governments within that. And within Extinction Rebellion, you can see that like the point is really that the government does something about it. But how much faith do we actually have in the change coming from government? Because I think that's the big question at this point, is that the government is acting more as an obstacle rather than as something that will help us move forward at this point.
Yeah, that's something I kind of wonder, because with the sort of citizens' assembly idea, we're in a context of constitutional crisis and a potential Scottish independence referendum sometime near future. Now, that citizens' assembly within Scottish Parliament would be one kind of vision of a just transition that we could have. But my sort of impression of the Scottish government is that they are so managerial and distant to the voice of any kind of populist force. So I'm not quite sure to what extent they'd actually like listen to the message. I still feel like there's some sort of inequity of power, maybe. But maybe that'll change with bigger movements, I don't know.
I think like the SNP's kind of like profile has always been to try and change their message into what's kind of popular in the at the moment. So a couple of years ago, Nicola Sturgeon was a really strong supporter of oil and gas, and we've got loads of quotes from them, and they based the independence referendum on that. And now they've like really changed to the fact that they like this climate bill is, in inverted commas, the most ambitious world leading climate bill. She often speaks at like UN COPs, like she was at a sea marine conference last week. So they actually changed their messaging a lot to fit the people. And I wonder if the fact if you force these issues through, you kind of make them have no choice in the matter. I don't know how much I believe that, but that's just from seeing how they've shifted politically recently.
And then it's also that it's not only Extinction Rebellion and the kind of like external pressures that kind of people are putting on the government. It's also a lot of NGOs who are kind of working in the lobbying side, talking to the politicians directly, and then there's divestment campaigns focusing on like smaller and more specific issues. So I suppose there's a combination of kind of this like public opinion kind of pressure and also very specific asks coming from all around them.
So one thing that we worry about with doing the messaging for Extinction Rebellion is, are our demands too ambitious? Mm. Are they not specific enough? Do we have to explain how we want things to happen? But then we're not the only big movement that's happening at the moment, and the youth strikes have got a lot more press attention. Even though in some places, like in Glasgow, the youth strike was organised by Extinction Rebellion students, it's a parallel movement. It's not necessarily connected. But that isn't one that has a specific message, and it's not something they have specific demands. It's something needs to change, and it needs to change now. And I really think that it's important to remember the power of movements that don't have specific demands.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to when, like, with our divestment campaign, we were asked to provide, like, figures and sort of numbers for why other investments would be more profitable, and it's kind of like that's not like our job or our interests. Like, we just want you to stop doing what you're doing.
Yeah, fair enough. If we had like a proper functioning like direct democracy, if you want to give us that, then by all means, and we've started to figure it out. But until such times, get up off your own arse and deal with the crisis.
Yeah, we were literally told to do a PhD on divestment and then come back with the results and maybe they'll consider it.
But it's really interesting you mentioning Extinction Rebellion students as being strong because they have no direct demands. But yeah, sometimes there's like an expression in French which is to put water in your wine, meaning to kind of dilute your ambition because you have to mirror the expectations that decision makers have for you. and we can see like how this has completely changed the ways that NGOs work, because they position themselves in a place where they have to already make some compromise between what they expect the government to do. But and so if you see it as a strength not to have any demands, then maybe it is that we have not much expectations for the change to come from government, and that a whole point of existing is to really change the mind of people and engage more and more people into a culture of rebellion. So what would you say that is the main goal of Extinction Rebellion? Or
this is probably where there might be a big difference between Extinction Rebellion and me. And it is, they do, I think, have quite clear demands, but yeah, it's not the explaining how exactly they want them to be done. But it is a movement that's got lots and lots of different people within it, and lots of different priorities and strategies. And I think for us in Scotland, the political climate is really different than it is in the UK. And we're probably seeing Extinction Rebellion in 210 countries or something like that now, even if it's just like one person in each country. It will be different according to the different political situations, but yeah, one conversation that people have had is targeting governments, really what we need to do when governments maybe don't have the real power. It's corporations and things like that.
Mm.
Something that we talked about in our last episode was that, like, the whole idea of a just transition, that's one vision for our future, and actually being sceptical of the Scottish Government even being possible of implementing a just transition is kind of similar to what you're saying. Is the existence of these governments in the states that they are actually a hindrance, and should we stop appealing to them then and start really building these alternative structures that make them insignificant, and how do we do that?
Yeah, totally. It's probably a far bigger topic, but nation states and capitalism have pretty much went hand in hand throughout history, haven't they?
Yeah, Extinction Rebellion will have a lot of different people with a lot of very different views along that spectrum. I would be totally with you as me, and I think a fair few people in Scotland would probably think the same thing. But there's also, it is a movement that, despite having this really radical messaging style, does have this essentially quite reformist strand to it as well.
I wonder if, like, just the physical realities of the world in the next, like, decade, that will probably change that as well, because something we often do in the reformist strategies is appealing to the governments to change, but we're basing those requests on what the environment is like right now. And I think the more we see the world change as a result of climate change, that those requests will change and actually might incite more people to rebellion as well.
I guess at the moment a lot of groups have the kind of like two sides to them. Like, our campaign as well is super reformist in the sense that we're asking a pension fund to divest its money from fossil fuels and invest into something else. It's super working within the system. But then we have this other side of the campaign, which is building communities and empowering other people to go into climate activism, and to kind of, yeah, creating the social structures that need to exist for the different bigger kind of change to take place. So we're kind of fighting on two fronts in that sense, probably in a similar way to Extinction Rebellion Scotland.
So I feel like what you just described there almost is like pragmatism versus like radicalism. And that's a tension I always feel like I'm living in, and I can't quite ever solve it.
Pragmatism today is radicalism, and that you do have like reformism, but as Yanni says, this is like the face that we put on the outside when we're asking decision makers to consider us as legitimate. But like, most of our work isn't done in like a reformist way. This is like just a face that we keep in order to appear okay in the eyes of those politicians.
Yeah, I think there is like a much bigger conversation to be had about the ability to hold that tension, and I think that's something that we are learning to work with.
I feel like it has definitely a function, having that kind of that phase of doing the reformist activism, so that we kind of have like a specific goal that keeps us together, keeps us working, keeps us meeting every week, doing something. Because if it would be so easy to just kind of like let it go and hang out as a group of friends who agree about everything and don't do much about anything. And then also it feels like it's almost buying us time, like trying to like do tiny, tiny changes in the system just in case we can't break off of it fast enough.
It is to see people stepping forward, stepping up, becoming empowered to take on roles and do things, and that is a big thing about this being a movement that is non-hierarchical and it's just that letting people know, no, if you want to do it, you can do it. That you know, that seems like a fine idea with another couple of people. It works with the main values of the group, so go ahead, you can do it, you don't need to check with me. And I think you just see that sense of, oh, I can do something. And I'm just experiencing it in my own life after being ground down by being part of academic institutions for years, that I can do something, I can do stuff, and not have to judge it about how it's going to rank in league tables and things like that. And yeah, I'm thinking a lot about your podcast about the quitting your job thing. And I think it's that sense of what people can achieve as groups, even like us trying to plan an action over the last few days, and there's been some debates about it, but we've made a breakthrough with how we're going to do it. And there's that real sense of, yes, people together without any one person in charge can get stuff done, and that's just really amazing.
It's really funny that we keep trying to stay off the group culture chat, but actually I think this just reveals that that's really one of the core tactics to having radical change to climate change, is reforming these communities and these group cultures. So it's just nice that we keep falling back into it, because it's some of the best work that we do.
Yeah, I really liked Yeni's point on the fact that like having a reformist goal is kind of like the glue that keeps the group together. And it is important, because even though those asks are not going to be a silver bullet, they're still very important for movement building itself. And you can see it within Extinction Rebellion, having the demand of a citizens assembly is like an achievable goal that kind of keeps people pushing. And you see the Gilets Jaunes movement in France came up with a similar ask, and now this is the main demand, and people are still going every Saturday in the streets of Paris for like 15 weeks and asking, because they managed to like get together that one demand that can still unite people from the whole across the whole political spectrum.
This might not work, but we'll go for it. A little round table on what gives us hope in terms of what we see in terms of action in the world around us.
Yeah, the youth strikes. Me and Bobby were at them on Friday, and there was something so wonderful about seeing like the generation after ours really taking onus of this this cause with us. And actually, because I've spent a lot of my time talking to people who are older than me about this and trying to get them to care, it was really nice to see this like mountain of people already behind it with us who are younger. And I really feel that there's a moment there. And
seeing new faces at every meeting and every sort of interaction that I have with groups around Glasgow, that's what's really keeping me going. Margretta. And tweeting politicians and just amazing. And amazing. It shows that we will be able to keep going
been
forward, even if some of us are getting a little bit tired sometimes.
Yeah, in some weird sense, at the moment, I feel like I don't really have hope, in the sense that I like see a really hopeful future for the planet at the moment. But what keeps me going is just the kind of knowledge that we are doing something, we're in this fight together, and like we are moving somewhere and doing something together, and that's just the kind of thing that keeps me going, even with the hope kind of not sometimes being there.
Yeah, I think my feelings change every day about it. It's really difficult to kind of regulate your emotions around it sometimes, but actually one of the things for me is just building those connections, and like today it's been great to hear from you, and thanks for coming along. And yeah, it feels like the more connections we make, the kind of stronger we can build this, and even if the outlook isn't great for now, maybe it might be better tomorrow.
So something that gives me hope is just finding, much like Sarah said, finding this community of people who see climate change as like the existential threat that we've seen it as for years, but it seems like there's not been that many people around who, and maybe because I've not spoke to a lot of younger people as well, like people who are younger than me about this, but it's been really nice. And like when we were preparing for the direct action training that we were going to do last week, I read like a lot about Extinction Rebellion, and there was an article in The Guardian about your action in Parliament, and it was the way that it framed it. It was like, but the Scottish Government is the most radical government on climate change, and it was like the people at The Guardian really didn't get like your objection, like, and I thought that was really interesting, because it's like the furthest maybe left paper that we have. But there's still like it's not really sunk in for the journalist who was writing that maybe about climate change and how the Scottish Government maybe isn't, you know, like a structure which can actually deal with this. So I thought it was just and the tensions that keep coming up, like in and against, like and out with, like the state as well. Like we keep having these discussions as well, and I think it's just really refreshing to like meet with other people and share your thoughts and realise you're coming up against the same things and you can resolve some of them together. So yeah, hopefully.
So I think I've got hope from having a different idea of hope, as maybe not being about expecting that things are going to be okay, but saying that you're going to care about them anyway and try and do something about the future anyway. Last night we were at a film screening and a discussion around developments in Otago Lane in Glasgow, and basically a local community actions not working and the developers getting their way and people still wanting to try, and then and somebody said about, well, do you think it's going to do any good, and do you think what Extinction Rebellion are doing are going to have any do any good, do you think it's going to work? And it kind of asked us quite directly, and I was like, well, but we have to try, and that's in itself, that's the hope for me, the sense that we have to try.
The thing that gives me the most hope is seeing the complete unpredictability of all political dynamics. It's like within the last couple of years, everything that we had held for granted has been questioned, and people are like mass movements are popping up across many countries in the world. People are losing faith in their political establishment as well as in the media establishment that Dan was talking about before. So even if the establishment isn't moving on board with the climate crisis, the people are becoming more and more suspicious of their establishments, and so that's, we can see, like, we can still have a hope for the change to come from the very ground up, rather than expecting our government to fall in line.
You pretty much stole mine there, Matthew. just a real sense that probably the elites who have been running society and been managing things for us are just so out of touch, and that's definitely created a lot of sort of fertile ground for protest and action and meaningful change. And the climate strikes, I think, part of that, because some people have responded to that with kind of incredulity. And it's like, oh, you're so out of touch, you know. Mm. So that's probably where I get the most hope from. Mm. Things are changing. Mm. But again, this could be positive or negative, but cool. I have the hope.
I was just going to say something about how important, so communities, we've talked a lot about groups and communities and solidarity for each other and solidarity for causes kind of around the corner from us, but also around the world, and, you know, looking to Brazil and looking much further away and building a global movement. So the local and the global, you know, really matter, and the people are really what matter, and we're caring for each other and we're taking people with us, and the more we can reach out and the more work we do on being an inclusive movement, I feel like that's where I see hope.
All right, well, I think that wraps up another episode of Fossil Free Now. Thanks everyone for listening, and a big thank you as well to Bobby and Anna for their contributions today, and hopefully we'll see much more of you guys in the future too.
And you can find Extinction and Rebellion Scotland on Facebook and Twitter, right?
Yeah, and Instagram.
And Instagram.
And we're in those places too.
Yeah.